Penguin Random House Audio presents Wicked Charms, a Lizzie and Diesel novel by Janet Ivanovich and Fief Sutton. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1. My name is Lizzie Tucker, and I live in a small, slightly tilted historic house that sits on a hill overlooking Marblehead Harbor in Massachusetts. I inherited the house from my great-aunt Ophelia when I was 28, and I'm not much older now. I share the house with a tiger-striped, short-haired cat. When he was rescued from the shelter, his tag said Cat 7143, and it stuck as his name. Cat has one eye, half a tail, and I'm pretty sure he was a ninja in a past life. I'm a Johnson & Wales Culinary School graduate, and when I'm not being asked to save the world, I work as a pastry chef at Dazzle's Bakery in Salem. It was 10 o'clock at night. Cat and I were watching television in bed, and a big, scruffy, incredibly hot guy walked into my bedroom. "What the heck?" I asked. "Where did you come from?"
"Originally, Switzerland, but I was mostly raised in Southern California."
"That's not what I mean. What are you doing in my bedroom?" He kicked his shoes off.
"I'm undressing, and then I'm going to bed."
"No, not allowed."
"Extenuating circumstance," he said, peeling off his shirt. "I'm between places of residence."
"I don't care if you're between a rock and a hard spot. You can't stay here." His jeans hit the floor.
"Of course I can. We're partners."
"We're not that kind of partners. We work together. We're not supposed to be, you know."
"Don't get your panties in a bunch. I have total self-control."
I leaned forward for a closer look. "Are those parrots on your boxers?"
"I got them in Key West. Cool, right?"
"Okay. I have to admit it. The whole package was cool. The guy's name is Diesel. That's it. Only one name. And the name suits him because he plows over you like a freight train. He's over 6 feet of hard-muscled male perfection. His dark blonde hair is thick and sun-streaked and perpetually mussed. His eyes are brown and unreadable. His smile is like Christmas morning. His attitude is deceptive, casual on the outside but intense on the inside. His moral code is all his own." "All right, you win," I said, knowing there was no way I could physically remove him. "You can sleep on the couch." He stuck his thumb into the waistband on his boxers.
"I don't fit on the couch."
"Hey," I said, "wait a minute." Too late. The boxers were on the floor with his shirt and jeans. I clapped my hands over my eyes. "I can't believe you just did that."
"I sleep nude. Women don't usually mind."
"I mind."
"I get that," Diesel said. "Move over."
I have a queen-size bed, plenty big enough for me and Cat, not big enough for me and Cat and Diesel. Truth is, I wouldn't mind getting romantic with Diesel, but we have an odd relationship. Diesel isn't normal, and it would seem that I'm not normal either. I thought I was normal until Diesel popped into my life shortly after I moved to Marblehead. Now weird is the new normal. The way Diesel tells it, there are some people on Earth who have enhanced abilities that can't be explained in ordinary ways. They might be useful abilities, such as Diesel's talent for opening locks. Or they might be hellacious powers, such as calling down lightning or levitating a garbage truck. Crazy, right? It gets even better. Supposedly, there are 7 ancient stones that hold the powers of the 7 deadly sins. They're known as the 7 Seligia stones. If these stones fall into the wrong hands, all hell will, quite literally, break loose. I'm one of 2 people in the world who have the ability to locate the stones, sort of like a human divining rod. Lucky me. So far, Diesel and I have acquired 2 of the stones, nearly getting blown up and kidnapped and chopped into tiny pieces with a broadsword in the process. When we find a stone, Diesel sends it off to some higher power for safekeeping. At least that's his story. "We're not supposed to sleep together," I said.
"Sleeping is okay. Getting busy, not so much."
Turns out if 2 people with enhanced abilities get busy, one of them will discover that their special powers have gone up in smoke. If I could be sure it was my special powers that would disappear, I'd be happy to take one for the team.
But what if it was Diesel who got cleaned out? I'd be on my own to save the world. This wouldn't be a good thing. I grabbed a pillow and put it between us. Just to be safe, I said. Sweetheart, if I decide to risk my abilities, that pillow isn't gonna save you. My alarm went off at 4:15 in the morning, and I rolled over into Diesel. He was deliciously warm, he smelled like gingerbread cookies, and the pillow was missing. Hey, I said, are you awake?
I am now.
Something's poking at me under the covers, I said. That better not be what I think it is.
Maybe you should take a look just to be sure you've identified it correctly.
That would be awkward.
I could deal, Diesel said.
It might lead to things. I sensed him smile in the dark room.
No doubt.
He moved over me and kissed me. There was some tongue involved, and heat fluttered into every part of me. So maybe I could save the world on my own if it came down to that, I thought. Maybe I didn't care if one of us lost our abilities. Maybe I just cared about running my hands over every fantastic part of him, and then following it with my mouth, and then the inevitable would happen. Oh boy, I really wanted the inevitable.
Damn, Diesel said.
What? What damn? He slipped out of bed and got dressed in the clothes that were lying on the floor.
There's a problem, he said.
Can you solve it?
Absolutely.
He laced up his shoes.
I'll be back.
Chapter 2. 3 weeks later, Diesel still hadn't returned. Who cares, and good riddance, I told myself. My life was humming along just fine. Maybe it was a little dull compared to chasing down enchanted objects with Diesel, but at least no one was trying to kill me or kidnap me. Salem is half small-town USA, with its steepled churches, family neighborhoods, and traditional New England values, and half Spooktown USA, with whole chunks of town devoted to the tourism industry built around the Salem witch hunts of the late 1600s. Personally, I don't buy into the witch thing. But Glow, the counter girl at Dazzle's, is smitten with the possibility that she might secretly be Samantha Stevens of Bewitched. Truth is, if Glow channels anyone from that television series, it's Aunt Clara. Glow is 4 years younger than me and an inch shorter, so that puts her at 5'4". She has curly red hair chopped into a short bob. She lives with a broom she hopes will someday take her for a flight over Salem. Her wardrobe can best be described as goth meets sugar plum fairy. I'm not nearly as colorful as Glow. I have blonde hair that is almost always pulled back into a ponytail. My eyes are brown, my metabolism is good, and my wardrobe lacks imagination. White chef coat, jeans, t-shirt, sneakers, and a sweatshirt if it's a chilly night. Glow and I had closed up shop for the day, and her latest boyfriend, Josh something, was giving us an after-hours tour of Salem's Pirate Museum. Josh works as a guide in the museum and was in period dress, a white puffy-sleeved shirt, black and red striped breeches, and a grungy leather knee-length frock coat. His brown hair was long and tied with a slim black ribbon at the nape of his neck, and he usually wore a patch over his left eye. Since we were the only ones in the museum, his patch was up on his forehead.
"And look here, my lassies," Josh said to Glow and me, pointing to a grim replica of an unfortunate pirate prisoner. "This be a fine example of pirate justice. 'Tis a nasty way to end a life. The lad would have been better off thrown to the sharks."
The prisoner's leather-like skin was stretched tight over his skull and bony frame, and his mouth was open in a perpetual, silent scream. The creepy mannequin was dressed in the sort of rags you'd expect to find on a desiccated corpse, and this phony-looking, partially rotted thing was stuffed into a flimsy cage that hung from a rusted chain attached to the ceiling. The rest of the room was filled with artifacts, both real and not so real. Cannons, cannonballs, maps under glass, cutlery, jugs of rum, a stuffed rat, coins in a small open chest. Timbers, ropes, and weapons were all displayed in dim light. It's hard to get emotional over something that's so obviously fake, I said.
Aye, Josh said, he be a bit worn. The scurvy dog has been in that cage a good long time.
I could try to put a spell on him to perk him up a little, Glow said.
A while back, Glow found Ripple's book of spells in a curio shop, and she's been test-driving Ripple's recipes ever since, with varying results.
It might help if you gave the cage a coat of Rust-Oleum, I said.
I reached up and touched the cage. There was some creaking, dust sifted down on us, and the chains separated from the bars. The cage crashed to the floor and broke into several pieces. The imprisoned dummy flopped out, its peg leg fell off, the skull detached from the neck, and its arm snapped in half. We all gaped at the mess in front of us. The prisoner's leathery skin was split where the arm had cracked, and a bone was protruding.
"Arrgh," Josh said.
"I think that be a human bone," I whispered.
It took the first cop 5 minutes to get to the museum. He was followed by three more uniformed cops, two plainclothes cops, a forensic photographer, and two EMTs. Everyone stared down at the broken cage and the ghoulish guy with the bone sticking out of his arm, and everyone said pretty much the same thing. "I was here a couple days ago with my brother-in-law, and I thought this was a fake." By the time the coroner arrived, a museum official was on the scene. The area had been roped off with crime scene tape, and the body, which looked more like a giant Slim Jim than a human being, had been photographed and outlined in chalk. The coroner was a pleasant-looking guy in a wrinkled gray suit and wrinkled white dress shirt. He was my height, probably in his late 30s, wore Harry Potter glasses, had sandy blonde hair, and was soft enough around the middle to look cuddly. His name was Theodore Nurgle. Nurgle slipped under the crime scene tape and knelt beside the corpse.
"Yep," he said. "This guy's dead."
One of the plainclothes cops looked over the tape.
"It's a real flesh and blood body, right?"
Nurgle nodded.
"It was flesh and blood before someone decided to try his hand at mummification. Now it's tanned hide and partly calcified bone."
He pulled on disposable gloves, picked the skull up, and examined it.
"There's an entrance wound in the back of the head where he's been shot."
He shook the head, and there was a rattling sound, like dice in a cup. He tipped the head forward, and a small lump of misshapen metal fell out of the man's mouth and plopped into the coroner's hand.
"This is a lubeloy round manufactured only in the 1920s, Nurgle said. "This man was shot some 90 years ago.
"Wow," Glow said. "I guess you'll put out an APB for a perp with a walker and a hearing aid."
"Harg again," Josh said.
Nurgle set the skull in the vicinity of the corpse's neck and stood.
"Who found this?"
"We did," I said. "Josh works in the museum, and he was giving us an after-hours tour. I touched the cage, and it came crashing down."
"And you are who?"
"Lizzie Tucker," I said. "I'm a pastry chef at Dazzle's Bakery."
His eyes widened.
"Do you make the red velvet cupcakes?"
"I do."
"I love those cupcakes."
Nurgle went back to examining the Slim Jim, and Glow elbowed me.
"He loves your cupcakes," she said. "I heard."
She leaned close.
"He's cute," she whispered.
"And?"
"He's not wearing a wedding ring."
"And?"
"Neither are you."
"I don't think he's my type," I told Glow.
"Okay, so he examines dead people all day," Glow said. "Nobody's perfect. He probably has all kinds of interesting hobbies."
"Excuse me," I said to Nurgle. "Can we go now?"
"Of course," he said. "But don't leave town."
"Really?"
"Really," he said. "I'm addicted to your cupcakes."
Glow elbowed me again.
"I think he might be flirting with you," she whispered.
"It's the cupcakes," I said. "It has nothing to do with me. I'm leaving."
"I can't leave," Josh said. "I have to stay to lock up the museum."
"I'll stay with you," Glow said to Josh. "This is just like one of those CSI shows."
I gave everyone a wave goodbye and walked out of the museum into the warm July night. The streetlights cast little pools of light onto the shadowy sidewalk. One of the lights flickered just as I reached it, blinking out twice before flaring back to life brighter than ever. I felt a chill ripple down my spine and goosebumps erupt on my arms. A man was standing under the streetlight. He was deadly handsome in a scary, sexy vampire sort of way. He had pale skin, piercing dark eyes, and shoulder-length raven black hair that was swept back from his face.
He was dressed in a perfectly tailored black suit with a black dress shirt. I knew him, and there had been times when I thought his soul might be black as well. His name is Gerwulf Grimoire, mostly known as Wolf. He entered my life shortly after I moved to the North Shore. He'd introduced himself, touched his fingertip to the back of my hand, and left a burn mark. The scar is still there.
"Miss Tucker," he said, "we meet again."
"Nice to see you, Wolf."
"I'm sure that's not true," Wolf said, "but I appreciate the lie. I'm here to relieve you of the coin you just found."
"What coin? What are you talking about?" Wolf studied me for a beat.
"You really don't know, do you?"
"I assume you're not looking for a nickel or a dime."
"Hardly. You'll soon know enough about the coin. I'm sure my cousin Diesel is looking for it as well and will enlist your aid. If you're smart, you won't get involved. Consider this a warning."
"I'm not afraid of you." Another lie.
"I'm the least of your worries," Wolf said.
There was a pop and a puff of smoke, and Wolf was gone. Vanished. A text message from Glow buzzed on my phone. "Locking up in 10 minutes, going to Shipside on Wharf Street for Jose Cuervo for me, and bringing Cute Coroner for you. Meet you there." The ship's side was a glorified clam shack with the requisite gray shake siding on the outside and decorated with nets, buoys, and lobster traps on the inside. We were seated at a round table on the back porch overlooking Salem Harbor. Josh was still in costume and still in character.
"I'll have a grog," he said to the waitress. "Sorry, hon," she said. "We don't carry grog. You'll have to settle for beer." "You see this?" Josh said. "This is another example of how mainstream society refuses to serve the needs of my people."
"Your people?" I asked. "Do you mean pirates?"
"We prefer the term Buccaneer Americans," Josh said. "So does the Buccaneer American want beer?" the waitress asked. "Aye," Josh said.
"I can't help noticing that you talk like a Buccaneer American even when you're not at work," Nurgle said to Josh.
"'Tis a terrible curse," Josh said. "I speak buccaneer all day, and then I can't stop. My brain doth think in buccaneer."
"I like it," Glow said. "Sometimes he says I'm winsome."
"True enough, ye be a winsome lass," Josh said to Glow.
"Fortunately, I can stop speaking in coroner," Nurgle said. Josh nodded.
"Speaking in coroner after hours wouldst be a bummer."
"It seems like an odd occupation," I said to Nurgle. "Why did you become a coroner?"
"I was in debt after med school, and this opportunity happened along. I know it seems gruesome to the average outsider, but it's really very interesting work. Why did you become a baker?"
"I flunked gravy when I was in culinary school, but I was good at making cupcakes." I felt someone lean into me, and a long arm reached out for the bread basket. I recognized the arm. It belonged to Diesel. He scraped a chair up to the table and positioned himself between Nurgle and me.
"So what's new?" Diesel said, giving my ponytail a playful tug.
I was momentarily dumbstruck. "Where the heck were you?" I said to him. "One minute you were in my house, and the next thing you were gone. For all I knew, you were dead. I haven't heard a word from you in weeks. You didn't even say goodbye."
"I was on a job, and I'm pretty sure I said goodbye."
"The last thing you said to me was, I'll be back."
"And?"
"I'll be back is not goodbye." Diesel took a roll from the breadbasket.
"This is why I don't work with women."
"You do work with women. I'm a woman."
"Yeah, but I have no choice. I only had two options, and Wolf snagged option number one. He got to Stephen Hatchett first."
I thunked my forehead with the heel of my hand. Stephen Hatchett is the only other person with the ability to recognize a disguised stone. It's sort of insulting that Diesel would consider Hatchett to be the number one choice, since Hatchett is flat out nuts. He looks like an underbaked dinner roll with legs. He has scraggly red hair, is around my age, and thinks he's a medieval minion serving his liege lord, Wolf. "You're crowding the table," I said to Diesel. "This table only has room for four."
"You're bummed, right?" Diesel said.
"Yes, go away." The waitress returned with our drinks and asked if we wanted to order food. Glow ordered a burger. Josh ordered fried clams. Nurgle ordered a lobster roll, and I ordered rice pudding.
I'll have a lobster roll, too, Diesel said.
No, he won't, I said to the waitress. He's not with us.
He's sitting with you, the waitress said.
He's a squatter, I said. Don't encourage him. The waitress gave him a full body scan.
If it was me, I'd totally encourage him. I'll have a beer with my lobster roll, Diesel said.
No, he won't, I said.
What kind of beer do you want? The waitress asked Diesel. Surprise me, he said. And I'll have a second lobster roll to go. My monkey's in the car and he's hungry. That is so adorable, the waitress said. What's your monkey's name?
Carl, Diesel said. And it would be great if you could hurry things along because Carl is probably gnawing on the steering wheel.
We just got back from Sri Lanka, and he's still freaked over the elephants. There were lots of elephants.
This is Theodore Nurgle, I said to Diesel, and the guy with a patch on his forehead is Josh the pirate.
Arg, Josh said to Diesel. Who be you?
I be Diesel, Diesel said.
What were you doing in Sri Lanka? Nurgle asked Diesel.
This and that, Diesel said.
Ah, one thing and another, Nurgle said.
Diesel ate half his dinner roll.
You got it.
Was it difficult getting your monkey into the country without a quarantine period? Nurgle asked.
There was a long pause where no one spoke, and everyone looked at Diesel.
He's a service monkey, Diesel finally said.
Not to mention, Diesel doesn't fly by ordinary means.
You'll never guess what happened tonight, Glow said to Diesel. Josh was giving us a tour of the Pirate Museum, and one of the exhibits came crashing down at our feet, and it turned out to be a real dead guy. That's how we got to meet Dr. Nurgle. He's a coroner, and he was awesome. He figured out that the guy had been shot, and he knew all about the gun and everything, and he figured out the guy had been shot over 90 years ago.
Impressive, Diesel said.
Nurgle shook his head. Not at all. It was obvious.
The head fell off when the dead guy hit the floor, Glow said. And it was as if the instant Dr. Nurgle touched the head, he knew all this stuff.
He had a bullet hole in the back of his skull, and the round was still contained in the cavity, Nurgle said to Diesel.
The waitress brought the food, and we all dug in. Nurgle was halfway through his lobster roll when his phone buzzed. He read the text message and tapped in a response.
This has been fun, he said, pushing back from the table, leaving his share of the bill. But I have to be going. Duty calls.
He seems nice, Diesel said to me when Nurgle left. You should consider going out with him.
You think? I asked. A half hour later, we left the restaurant. Josh walked Glow to her car, and Diesel and I walked up Wharf Street to my tan Chevy clunker.
I sense a disturbance in the force, Diesel said.
Gee, I can't imagine why. Maybe it's because one minute we're in bed together, and then all of a sudden you get dressed and leave, and I don't hear from you for 3 weeks, and then I find out you've been in Sri Lanka.
Well, where did you think I was?
I don't know. A drugstore. I thought you were going out for condoms.
Yeah, looking back, I could see where that might have been a possibility.
He slung an arm around me and nuzzled my neck.
Maybe we should take up where we left off.
You're actually willing to risk one of us losing our abilities?
I think I could work around it.
No way, I'm not taking the chance. Besides, I'm not even sure I like you.
Of course you like me. I'm fun.
I had an earlier run-in with Wolf, and now you're here, I said to Diesel. What's going on?
Do you know about Martin Ammon?
I know he's a billionaire.
Martin Ammon is a publishing and media giant, Diesel said. He owns a bunch of newspaper and media outlets in England and the U.S., He also has a reputation as a devourer of companies, big and small. He's an eccentric, power-hungry megalomaniac. His great-grandfather was Billy McCoy, a notorious rum runner during Prohibition. McCoy's partner was Peg Leg Dazzle.
Was Peg Leg related to the bakery Dazzles?
I imagine all the Salem Dazzles are related, but I don't know where Peg Leg fits in. Anyway, McCoy and Peg Leg, at some point in their illegal endeavors, came across a diary and an accompanying coin. The diary belonged to a pirate named Palgrave Bellows, and it detailed a treasure he'd hidden on an island off the coast of Maine. The coin was supposed to help read Palgrave's treasure map. Unfortunately for McCoy and Peg Leg, the map wasn't with the diary and the coin,
and they were never able to find the treasure. A bunch of years ago, the diary fell into Ammon's hands, and he became obsessed with finding the treasure. He bought a house on Marblehead Neck, and he buddied up with a history professor. The two of them put a lot of time and money into the project, but nothing came of it.
How do you know all this?
It wasn't a secret. There were newspaper articles about the diary and the lost treasure of the Gunsway.
The Gunsway?
That was the name of the ship that Palgrave plundered. It originated in the Far East, and according to the diary, it contained unimaginable riches, both ordinary and magical.
Wow, magical.
Yeah, that's where Wolf and I come into the picture. The magical part of the treasure, if the diary is to be believed, is the Avaritia Stone, the Stone of Avarice. Ammon never made a big deal about the stone in all his interviews, but I suspect his real goal was to get his hands on it. He's made joking references in the past about his drive to acquire more and more money, and says that it's appropriate his parents named him Martin. If you combine his first initial with his last name, it spells Mammon, one of the seven princes of hell, and the personification of wealth and greed.
That wouldn't be my first choice for a prophetic name.
Yeah, me either. I'd rather my name was B. Irgut.
It took me a beat to figure it out. That's gross, I said.
Diesel grinned and tucked a loose strand of hair behind my ear, his touch giving me a rush that went from my ear to my doodah.
Want me to try again? Diesel asked. No, I want you to finish telling me about the treasure.
Ammon managed to get hold of the map that Palgrave Bellows fashioned. It was discovered during a ship restoration project. Ammon tucked the map under his arm, and he still has it.
So now Ammon has the diary and the map.
Yep. Problem is, the directions to the treasure are in code, and the code can't be read without the special coin. Ammon hired a team of cryptographers, but they weren't able to crack the code without it, so all attention turned to finding the coin.
How long have they been looking for the coin?
Years. Ammon sent a private investigator on the case.
Looking for the coin?
Yes, but eventually looking for Peg Leg. After interviewing a lot of people, the PI discovered that the coin and the diary were originally found together. But because McCoy and Pegleg didn't completely trust each other, McCoy took the diary and Pegleg took the coin. Shortly after that, Pegleg disappeared and was never seen again. It was thought he was shot over a keg of rum, but it never went beyond rumor. Last week, the Pirate Museum hung the prisoner cage, and it caught the attention of the detective. The cadaver had been dressed in pirate rags, but the peg leg had clearly been made in more modern times.
I didn't notice, I said. It just looked like a wooden peg leg to me. And you know all this how?
The organization that employs me has had a man watching Ammon's detective.
Diesel is a sort of cop, at least that's what he tells me. He works for a loosely organized hierarchy of people with special abilities. His primary job was to keep his peers on the straight and narrow. When he was assigned the task of finding the seven Seligia stones, the cop part of his job became secondary.
I was being brought back to Salem to get you into the museum when you took matters into your own hands, Diesel said.
It wasn't intentional. I was just on a tour with Glow's new boyfriend. How does Wolf know about this?
Wolf has his own underground and his own agenda. Hard to say how Wolf knows things sometimes. He just does.
So the idea now is that the coin is somehow attached to the pirate skeleton?
Maybe. Or maybe the history of the skeleton will lead to the coin.
When I touched the cage, I felt a vibration just before it broke loose and fell to the floor. It wasn't especially strong, and I thought it was probably just my imagination.
Honey, your imagination isn't that good.
I happen to have an excellent imagination. Sometimes I imagine my life is normal.
Yeah, that's a stretch, Diesel said. So maybe the coin was in the cage.
If it was, it had to be hidden somewhere. I didn't see a coin.
Who had access to him?
The only one who actually touched the skeleton while I was there was Nurgle. I'm sure the EMTs had their hands on him, but I left before they zipped him up and carted him off.
Diesel unlocked my car and opened the driver's side door for me. I have stuff to do, he said. I'll catch up with you later.
My house looks like it was sprinkled out with a lot of other houses from the big house salt shaker sometime in the 1700s.
The neighborhood is a mix of small houses built by cod fishermen, shoemakers, carpenters, and mariners, and a few larger houses that were owned by merchants and ship captains. Most of the houses still have a wooden sculpture of a golden cod above their doorways, a symbol of good luck. My golden cod was getting a little worn around the fins, and I'd had paint your fish in my mental to-do list for a while. I was later getting home than usual, and Kat was waiting at the door. I snatched my mail from the mailbox, said hello to Kat, and went straight to the kitchen. I poured some kitty crunchies into Kat's bowl, adding a slice of cantaloupe as apology for his delayed dinner. I browsed through my mail while Kat ate. Bills, junk mail, more junk mail. Uh-oh, letter from a publisher. A while back, I'd had an idea for a cookbook, Hot Guys Cooking for Hungry Women. I packaged up my ideas and recipes, and my manuscript was making the rounds of New York agents and publishers. Unfortunately, no one wanted it, and I'd come to dread opening the letters that were inevitably rejections. "What do you think, Kat?" I asked. "Should I open it? Do you have a good feeling about this one?" Kat was sinking his fangs into the cantaloupe and didn't appear to care a lot about the letter. "Okay," I said to Kat. "Wish me luck." I tore the envelope open and read the letter. Rejection. Crap. "It's a great idea," I said to Kat, "and the recipes are perfect. I've kitchen tested them. I don't know why no one wants to buy my book." I went into my small living room and turned the television on. I flipped through channels until I came to the Food Network. I watched a half hour of cooking and moved on to Property Brothers on HGTV. They cooked in an entirely different way. Kat had followed me into the living room and was curled up on the couch next to me. "This is what I need," I said to Kat. "I need the Property Brothers. They work cheap, they always deliver on time, and they're cute." I heard the front door open, and Kat gave a low growl. His ears rotated in the direction of the door, and he listened for a moment. He settled back with his nose tucked under a paw when Diesel and Carl walked into the room. Carl jumped off Diesel's shoulder, scuttled over to Kat, and sniffed him. Kat opened his one working eye, and Carl shrank back and wrapped his arms around Diesel's leg. No one messes with Kat. "Well," I said to Diesel. Diesel slouched onto the couch next to me so that I was bookended between Kat and Diesel. "I checked out the cage and I went over the entire floor of the exhibit room," Diesel said. "The coin wasn't there."
"And the dead guy?"
"I took a look at him, too. He was taken to the morgue and stored for an autopsy. No coin on the dead guy."
"What about Wolf?"
"I talked to Wolf. He hasn't got it."
"There were two EMTs who handled the corpse, and probably someone checked him into the morgue."
"And there was Dr. Death," Diesel said.
"Nurgle?"
"Yeah, my money's on Nurgle."
"I thought you liked him. You told me I should date him."
"He would have gone over the body and collected evidence before they closed the bag. He's the logical person to have found the coin."
"Did you go through his office?"
"Yeah, and the coin wasn't there," Diesel said. "It also wasn't listed in the evidence log." The Property Brothers signed off, and I stood and stretched.
"Bedtime," I said. "I need to be at the bakery early tomorrow."
"No problem," Diesel said, taking charge of the remote. "I'll be up later."
"Up? No, there's no up. You need to go home."
"I was thinking this was home."
"This is my home. Don't you have a home?"
"I have a beach house in the South Pacific, but it's kind of a far commute."
"Where did you live in Sri Lanka?"
"Monastery. Longest 3 weeks of my life."
"You used to have your own apartment here. What happened to it?"
"The guy who owned it came back to town."
Chapter 3. I shut the alarm off at 4:15. There was no big guy next to me. The sheets were cool. Nothing smelled like gingerbread. Hard to tell if I was happy or disappointed. I showered, dressed for work, and trucked down to the kitchen. No big guy there, either. I gave Kat a fresh bowl of water and some kitty crunchies. I got coffee brewing, popped a frozen waffle into the toaster, and shrieked when Wolf appeared without warning. "Jeez Louise," I said. "I hate when people just materialize. How did you get in here?"
"I have ways."
He glanced at the waffle in the toaster. Not a healthy breakfast, but then maybe you're not expecting to live that long.
What's that supposed to mean?
You're playing on the losing team and the stakes are high.
Another warning?
An offer to come over to my side. There are dark forces who know about you, know about your special abilities. When they come for you, they won't be easy to evade.
I'm just a baker. I don't even have a Facebook page. How would anyone know about me?
You aren't just a baker. You are an asset, and a very rare and useful one. That kind of secret doesn't stay secret very long from people who crave power. How do you think I found you? How do you think my cousin found you? And are you so sure he isn't interested in the stone for himself?
I'll take my chances with Diesel.
I could make your life very pleasant, Wolf said, or very uncomfortable. Which will it be?
Neither. Just leave me alone and let me do my job.
Finding the avarice stone for Diesel?
Making cupcakes. Wolf's lips curved ever so slightly into a hint of a smile. His eyes were dilated totally black. There was a flash of light, and he was gone. I looked over at Cat. His tail was bushed out like a bottle brush. It's a whole wheat waffle, I said to Cat. It's sort of healthy. Dazzle's Bakery has been owned and operated by a Dazzle since Puritan times and is now managed by Clorinda Dazzle. The shop is ancient, consisting of two rooms downstairs and a small apartment upstairs. The store part of the bakery fronts onto a narrow street that's close to the harbor. The floor is the original wide plank pine. The walls are whitewashed. The glass display cases are filled with cupcakes and cookies. Wicker baskets holding a variety of breads and breakfast pastries line the back counter. Clara and I work in the kitchen behind the shop, and between the two of us, we make everything that's sold up front. I rolled into the bakery at 5 o'clock. I flipped the light switch and dialed into 60s rock on my iPad. I love this part of my day when everything is a new beginning. I love that I'm the one to unlock the door and bring the bakery to life. I slipped on a white chef coat and got the yeast dough started. I had just moved on to cupcake batter when Clara showed up at 5:30. Clara is divorced, is in her early 40s, and lives in the apartment above the shop. She has a wiry mass of black hair shot with gray that she tries to contain in a knot at the nape of her neck. Her nose is Wampanoag Indian. The rest of her is sturdy New England pilgrim stock. I've been told that special abilities run in her family and that she used to be one of us. Several years ago, she made an unfortunate choice in the bedroom, and Clara was the one to get stripped of her power.
We have a lunch takeout for 12 with meat pies and cupcakes today, Clara said. Plus, Mr. Duggan will be here at 10 for his standing order of pretzel rolls.
I'm on it.
2 hours later, Glow swept in with her tote bag on her shoulder and her broom in hand.
Your tote bag has a big bulge in it, I said to Glow. I know. I made the most amazing purchase. I passed by a yard sale on my way to work just now, and a voice called out to me.
Like when you bought Ripple's Book of Spells.
Exactly. Only this voice belonged to Emily Shipton. It was her yard sale.
What did she sell you?
A magic eight ball, and she swore it could predict the future.
Glow took the eight ball out and held it in her hand.
Emily said it was empowered by her distant relative, Mother Shipton.
Mother Shipton was an English prophet who lived in a cave and died in the 1500s, Clara said. The magic eight ball is a toy invented by Mattel in the 1950s.
It could have been Mother Shipton's spirit, Glow said.
I looked over at Broom, and I swear I saw him twitch. Glow dropped the magic eight ball back into her tote.
I asked the eight ball if Lizzie would have another exciting night with Theodore Nurgle, and it said, as I see it, yes.
Who's Theodore Nurgle? Clara asked.
I fixed Lizzie up with a date last night, Glow said. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing, but he was very cool, a doctor.
He's a coroner, I said, and he smelled like formaldehyde. I was working with the large pastry bag piping pink cream cheese frosting onto a dozen cupcakes destined for a birthday party when Diesel sauntered in. Are you ready to go?
Diesel asked me. Ready to go where? I asked. It's 10 o'clock. I don't even get done till 1.
So 5 minutes? Diesel asked. Clara looked over from her workstation. Is it important?
You know how it is, Diesel said, picking up one of the cupcakes and taking a bite. The end of the world, maybe.
Clara shoved a strand of hair back from her forehead with her forearm.
Only maybe?
Probably, Diesel said.
If it's probably, then Lizzie can have another Save the World Day, but you're using them up fast, Clara said.
I wasn't in a rush to get on with saving the world. I'd been there and done that, and I wasn't anxious to do it again. Why can't you save the world by yourself? I asked Diesel. Why do I have to go along?
You have to do your touchy-feely thing. I'm big and strong and smoking hot, but I'm not touchy-feely.
This was all true. I'll be with you as soon as I finish this batch of cupcakes, I said to Diesel.
I'll help,
Diesel said, grabbing a second pastry bag off the counter.
No, I don't need help. How hard can it be? You just squeeze the bag and the stuff comes out.
Diesel squeezed the bag, and pink frosting shot out and hit me in the head. I rolled my eyes up, as if I could see the gunk that was now stuck in my hair. You did that on purpose, I said to Diesel. Diesel smiled wide and swiped some frosting off my forehead with his finger.
No, but I like it. It's a good look for you.
Glow was standing in the doorway. It's true, Glow said to me. Pink is your color.
Okay, enough fun, Diesel said. We need to get moving. Lots to do, and you have a meeting with Martin Ammon at 4.
Everyone froze.
Martin Ammon? Clara asked. The Martin Ammon?
He has a map and a diary that I'd like to see, Diesel said.
I went back to icing the cupcakes. So why don't you just introduce yourself and ask if you can see them?
Because I might want to see them for an extended amount of time, and it's more than that. It could be helpful if you got friendly with Ammon. You could keep your eye on him.
Why me?
You're cute, and you have a hook. You make magical cupcakes.
Yes, but
I was sitting in your kitchen, and I realized it would be easy for you to get friendly with Ammon. He's a publisher, and you have a cookbook.
You didn't.
Yeah, I did. You had a copy of your cookbook on the counter, so I messengered it over to him with a dozen cupcakes.
Where did you get the cupcakes?
You had them in your freezer.
Oh my God, crap on a cracker.
It's all good, Diesel said. I sent a note with the package saying how you had this amazing cookbook idea, and all he had to do was try one of your cupcakes to know they were like magic.
And?
And his assistant called right away and said that Ammon would like to see you at 4 o'clock at his Marblehead house.
That is so cool, Glow said. He's like mega rich. He's a gazillionaire. I bet his house is made out of gold. What are you going to wear? Are you going to dress up like a chef? Everyone stared at me, taking in my outfit. Jeans, sneakers, t-shirt under a chocolate smudge chef coat, hair punked up with pink frosting.
Maybe not a chef, Clara said.
You should get something new, Glow said. This is an important meeting. I shrugged out of my chef coat. While I'm at it, I should also get my hair done, buy some makeup, and lose 5 pounds. Don't forget a manicure, Glow said. I checked my watch and gave up a sigh. I have 6 hours, more or less, to whip myself into shape. I looked at Diesel. How much time do you think it will take to save the world?
Diesel grinned down at me. Less time than it will take for you to lose 5 pounds.
I followed Diesel out of the bakery to his SUV, and saw that Carl wasn't in the back seat. No monkey? I asked.
I left him at the apartment.
You have an apartment already?
I have friends in high places. They have ways of getting things done fast.
I had no idea what that meant, and I wasn't going to ask. I'd reached the conclusion that it was best not to know too much about Diesel. Wolf popped into my kitchen this morning, I said.
Diesel looked over at me. You have anything interesting to say?
Mostly it was dire warnings of my bleak future. 10 minutes later, Diesel pulled into the lot attached to Salem Hospital and parked. We entered the hospital and found our way to the state pathology department. Nurgle's office door was open, and Nurgle was working at his computer when we walked in. Knock, knock, I said.
Nurgle looked up and smiled. Hey, find any more mummies?
Nope, I said, just the one. We'd like some information on him.
I haven't done the autopsy yet, so there's not much to tell, Nurgle said.
Have you had a chance to look through his clothes?
Not since last night. Did you find anything last night? Diesel asked him.
Nurgle sat up a little straighter.
What do you mean?
While Diesel was talking to Nurgle, I walked around the room, skimming my hand across surfaces, looking for a vibration or a tingle or heat.
Was anything interesting stuck in his clothes? Diesel asked. Like a coin?
Nurgle went silent for a beat.
He finally said.
I put my hand on Nurgle's shoulder. Nothing.
Try his pockets, Diesel said.
Nurgle shrank away from me.
What's going on?
We think there might have been a coin on the dead guy, Diesel said, and it's not on him now.
How do you know? Nurgle asked.
I looked, Diesel said.
Nurgle jumped to his feet. You're not allowed to look. How did you get in to look?
I'm special, Diesel said.
I ran my hand over Nurgle's pants pocket and felt a definite vibration. He's got it, I said.
Nurgle moved away from me. You're freaking me out. Who are you? What are you?
I looked over at Diesel. You want to field this one?
You have the coin in your pocket, Diesel said to Nurgle.
So what? Nurgle said. It's not a crime. It's evidence.
I've seen the evidence list and the coin isn't on it, Diesel said. So it looks to me like you stole some evidence.
It's just an old coin, Nurgle said. It's not even a whole coin. It's just a piece of a coin.
He pulled it out of his pocket and held it in the palm of his hand.
Why are you so interested in this?
It's a small but important piece of a puzzle, Diesel said. Why did you want it?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you, Nurgle said. It's too weird.
Try me, Diesel said.
Nurgle adjusted his Harry Potter glasses.
If I touch a dead body, I can sense the last thing he or she was thinking before death.
He shifted foot to foot.
I know that's crazy. I used to think it was my imagination, but sometimes I learn things that turn out to be true.
Wow, I said. That's amazing.
He shrugged. Most people's last thoughts are pretty mundane. I get a lot of people wishing they'd worn clean underwear or wishing they'd deleted their browser history. Folks are surprisingly pragmatic.
So they don't get all profound at the end?
Not so much, Nurgle said. Still, every now and then, someone tells me something interesting, like the guy in the cage. I guess I shouldn't have taken the coin, but I didn't see any harm in it. I didn't think it had real value.
Do you have any other talents besides the dead thing? Diesel asked him. Can you fly? Can you talk to grasshoppers?
No, I can't do either of those things.
He's not listed in our database, Diesel said to me.
What database? Nurgle asked.
The one that records people with enhanced abilities, I said.
Nurgle's mouth dropped open, and his eyes got wide. You mean there are others?
Yep, I said. We're called unmentionables.
Not officially, Diesel said.
I looked over at him.
You told me we were called unmentionables.
That's more of a nickname, like calling people from Massachusetts massholes.
Well, what's the official name for people with enhanced abilities? I asked.
Diesel shrugged.
People with enhanced abilities?
I thought I was the only one, Nurgle said. I never told anyone, and now I find out there are others like me.
Not exactly like you, I said. We all have different talents. I can locate certain empowered objects. Some people can bend spoons. Others can make it rain.
That's so cool, Nurgle said. And you guys have, like, a club?
No club, Diesel said.
Do you have parties? Nurgle asked. Mixers?
Diesel grinned.
Sorry, dude, he said. No mixers.
So if you don't have parties, how did Lizzie get frosting in her hair?
Nurgle asked. It's work-related, I said, gesturing toward my head.
Tell me about the pirate prisoner, Diesel said to Nurgle. What did you learn from him?
The first thought I got was peg leg. That's how I found the piece of the coin. I heard the thought, and I looked down at the man's wooden leg and saw that a piece of a coin was lying next to it. It must have fallen out.
Did he have any other thoughts? The last thought he had before he was shot was, at least McCoy will never be able to find the treasure without all 8 pieces of the coin. And his attitude was odd. The guy was almost happy. No, not happy. Gloating. That's the closest I can come to it. Nurgle exhaled a long breath. I can't tell you how good it feels to talk about all this. Can I have the names of other people in the club? Do we have a Facebook page? No and no, Diesel said, taking the piece of coin from him. This is going to be a real pain in the ass, Diesel said when we got back to the car. Some idiot cut the coin up into 8 pieces.
Chapter 4
Clara was rolling out cookie dough in the kitchen when we returned. Have you finished saving the world? She asked Diesel. Just starting, Diesel said. I assume by now Glow's told you about the skeleton in the cage at the Pirate Museum. I know every detail, Clara said.
We've been doing some detective work, and it looks like the skeleton in the cage might be Peg Leg Dazzle, I said to Clara.
Clara stopped in mid-roll. Are you serious?
Pretty much, I said. Do you know anything about him?
Peg Leg was my great-uncle, Clara said. His real name was Collier. He was my grandfather's older brother. Gramps didn't know him very well because Collier disappeared when Gramps was just a kid, but we've all heard lots of stories about Collier. He was a cod fisherman who lost his leg when it got tangled in rigging during a storm. He chose a wooden peg leg over a prosthetic, gave up on cod fishing, and went into business with Billy McCoy. Gramps said Collier used to drive him to a soda fountain on Essex Street, buy him milkshakes, and tell him stories of pirates and buried treasure. He even gave Gramps a couple pieces of a coin that was supposed to be a clue to finding the most fabulous treasure of all time. Collier said he got the coin from a pirate named Bellows, and Gramps said the pieces matched up to a couple more pieces Collier kept in his peg leg.
I looked over at Diesel. Oh, boy.
No kidding, Diesel said. Did you ever get to see the pieces of coin Collier gave to your grandfather? Diesel asked. I did, Clara said. Gramps used to show them to me all the time when I was a kid.
Diesel pulled the pirate prisoner's chunk of coin out of his pocket and placed it on the workbench.
Did they look like this?
Yes.
Do you know what happened to them? Diesel asked. I assume Gramps still has them. He's still alive?
The Dazzles have surprisingly long lifespans, Clara said,
unless you partner up with Billy McCoy. Collier isn't the first McCoy partner to mysteriously disappear. I suspect McCoy wasn't good at sharing the wealth.
How old is Gramps? I asked Clara.
Gramps is 98, and he doesn't look a day over 110. I'd like to talk to him, Diesel said. You'll have to wait until tomorrow, Clara said. He's on a senior's bus trip to Mohegan Sun Casino. He likes to play the slots. He won't get back until late tonight.
The front door to the shop opened, and a beat later, Josh poked his head into the kitchen.
Ahoy there, he said. Permission?